Matthew chapter 3, or chapter 9, pardon me. Something revolutionary occurred when Jesus Christ came into this world. Something that unfortunately the people who were his contemporaries had not anticipated. Even the disciples that he had called and had followed him and had listened and heard his teaching did not clearly understand the nature of how radically new was his kingdom from everything else that they had assumed and anticipated that kingdom would be. The ministry of Jesus was very different from that of Jewish religious leaders. He came preaching and teaching in a fashion and in a form that astonished the people. At one point at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, the people are astonished and they say he preaches and teaches with such authority, unlike the scribes and the Pharisees. He came to bring to fulfillment all of those Old Testament scriptures, and what made him unique was that unlike everybody that had preceded him, everybody who had come before him, he could say, these words that you hear me reading, they speak of me. I am their fulfillment. I am the one who has come to fill up all of the law and the prophets and to bring to completion everything that you have known since the time the Old Covenant was given at Mount Sinai. I have come to inaugurate something that is new. The word new in the New Testament is used frequently, and we have been exploring what it means to be part of the new covenant. Now we are coming to a point in our study where I have laid the groundwork. I have tried to show you the relationship of the new covenant to the covenants that preceded it, the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the Davidic covenant, how they led up to and anticipated the climactic coming of Jesus Christ into this world and the newness that his ministry would bring. I have tried to emphasize that there is both continuity between the new covenant and those covenants that went before them, but there is also discontinuity. And in fact, the majority of times that you see the new covenant mentioned and the newness of Jesus Christ talked about, it is not his continuity with that which went before, but his discontinuity that's highlighted. And we have a case in point in this parable which Jesus gives. Now, the background to the parable is this. In verse 14, the disciples of John come to Jesus. These are the disciples of John the Baptist. And even though they have heard John say, Jesus is the Messiah, he is the Christ, he is the one that we have been waiting for, they are still perplexed, as was John the Baptist while he was in prison, about the way in which Christ was conducting his ministry. They just couldn't understand why he was so different from their leader, John. And one of the questions that came up was in reference to fasting. And this is the question they asked. They said, why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast? It was part of the religious culture with both the Pharisees and John the Baptist, who was probably a member of the Essene group, the kind of Spartan living group of people who lived out in the desert and probably, incidentally, were responsible for the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran. It was part and parcel of their life to do regular fasting. You'll remember at one point Jesus talks about the Pharisees and that when they fasted, everybody knew about it. Because as soon as they started fasting, they walked around with their face fallen and their countenance low, and everybody said, hey, the Pharisees are fasting again. Jesus says, don't let people see your religious worship externally. He said, if you're doing it for the praise of men, that's all you get. But the disciples of John the Baptist are perplexed at this. Why is it that they live this kind of Spartan, Essene lifestyle where, like the Pharisees, they are fasting, but the disciples of Jesus aren't? That's the question. Why doesn't Jesus fit into those old molds, those old religious molds that they are so used to? And this is how he answers. He says, "Can the friends of the bridegroom mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast." By the way, I think he's saying there, not of their own will. The fasting will be because they're being run out of the synagogues and out of the cities, and they are without food. "No one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch pulls away from the garment and the tear is made worse. Nor do they put new wine into old wineskins, else the wineskins break, the wine is spilled, and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved." So Jesus gives these parables so that they will begin to understand that they should expect his ministry no longer to fit into the expected patterns of Jewish life and Jewish worship. In other words, he is saying, there is at least some discontinuity between my ministry going forward and what their ministry has been up till this point. And you have to realize that. And it wasn't really until his resurrection and his ascension that all of this began to be understood by his followers. Even after the resurrection, in Acts chapter 1, the disciples come to him and say, "Okay, Lord, is it now time for you to restore the kingdom to Israel?" And Jesus said to them, "It is not yours to know the time or the hour, but my Father who is in heaven. Go to Jerusalem. Wait there. The Holy Spirit will come, and then you will understand these things." So that's what they do. But Jesus describes his ministry in three different ways here, with three different parables. If you were in our Sunday school class, when we looked through the parables, these will be reminiscent for you. You'll remember these. The first way in which he describes it is at a wedding feast. Now, a Jewish wedding isn't like our weddings. You know, when we have a wedding today, we have the ceremony. Everybody comes and they sit in the sanctuary and they wait for the groom and the bride to enter. They watch the procession. They see the ceremony. They participate a little bit, maybe if there's a hymn that's sung or whatever the case may be. And then after the ceremony, and the pastor has pronounced the man and the woman, husband and wife, everybody adjourns and goes and eats. Maybe at a reception, maybe at a dinner, whatever the case may be. That's not the way it was in a Jewish life. The feast was the ceremony. There would be this great procession bringing the groom to the house of the bride. And everybody would follow, and lamps would be lit, and singing would be done as the bridegroom would come to see the bride. And then they would join together, and they would sit around the tables, and they would eat, and they would drink, and it would go on for hours. And in a while, they would pick up the bride, and they'd pick up the groom on their shoulders, and they would walk around the dinner table singing, and there would be a little ceremony, and they'd eat and drink some more. It was a social occasion. It was a time of great celebration, and it literally went on for hours. Now, Jesus says, how offended would the groom be if the friends that he had invited to the wedding ceremony showed up to this dinner and sat over in the corner with their faces drawn, looking very sad because they had decided to fast while everybody else was eating and drinking? He says, nobody who is a friend of the groom fasts when the groom is here. It's time for celebration. It's something new that is occurring. It is a time for everyone to be excited once the groom has left. They'll fast. That's because they'll be scourged, and they'll be thrown into prison, and they will be treated shamefully, and they will be hurt and killed, and they will starve. They'll fast. But as long as the groom is here, there's no time to fast. It's time to eat and drink and be merry because we are at a wedding banquet. What's the very first miracle that Jesus did? And where was it? That's right. He goes to a wedding at Canaan. And the wedding has gone on evidently for a long period of time, and all the wine is gone. And Jesus' mother, Mary, comes to him and says, "This is an embarrassment. We're not nearly through with the wedding, but all of the wine has completely disappeared." So Jesus has water brought in, and he turns that water into wine, and it goes on unending, unflowing. And everyone comments that this is much better wine than everything that had gone on before that. Now, why do you think he chose the wedding feast at Cana to be the first demonstration of his miraculous powers? It is because that wedding motif would become a very important characterization of his kingdom from there on out. He would talk about it over and over and over again. In fact, when we are all gathered home to heaven, and time comes to an end, and eternity is ushered in, it is described as coming to the marriage supper of the Lamb. When the bride, all of the elect from all times, will finally be pure and spotless and perfect and dressed in the righteousness of her bridegroom, and she appears before him, and you talk about celebration. From there through all of eternity, there is going to be one unending, ceaseless amount of happiness and joy like no Jewish wedding has ever had before. And so Jesus says to the disciples of John, "You don't understand. While I am here ministering with these people, it's not a time to fast and mourn. It is a time to celebrate because something new and revolutionary is here." But he goes on to describe it in the second way. He says, "Not only is my coming into this world like a celebration, but think of it this way." He says, "Imagine, gentlemen, that you've come home from a hard day of work, and you've got a big rip in the knee of your pants. Your wife, who just bought those pants for you 2 weeks ago, and is a little put out with you that you wouldn't be more careful." Does that sound autobiographical? Says, "Give me the pants." But she's already washed those pants several times, and the pants have already shrunk as far as they're going to shrink. She measures the hole, and she cuts out a piece of cloth, new cloth, cloth that's never been washed, so that it fits perfectly into the rip into your breeches. She then sews that cloth into the rip and gives them back to you to wear. You take them out, you get them dirty, you bring them back, you throw them in the dirty clothes, and she puts them into the wash the next day. What happens after it gets washed and it dries? That new piece of cloth, which had perfectly fit the tear, now shrinks. The rest of the pants have already shrunk. The new piece of cloth shrinks, and it pulls away from the seams, and it rips once again. Jesus says, "Now, just in case you don't understand that, let me give you another illustration. Imagine that you have a wine sack." Now, we don't carry around wine sacks with ourselves today, but they did in the Middle East. They were made of animal skins, leather. And of course, Israel is in a very dry, arid climate. And in time, those animal skins would become hard and more brittle. Now, if you take new wine and you put it into the wine skins, the fermentation process begins immediately. And as that fermentation process goes on, gases are given off, and the wineskin begins to expand. But it's old, hard, leathery wineskin that's very brittle, and eventually you wake up one day and you look, and all of the wine has been spilt out on the ground because it burst under the pressure of the fermentation process inside. Now, the parable of the new cloth and the parable of the wineskin was designed to teach these disciples of John and to teach us that the ministry of Jesus was not going to fit inside the old paradigms, inside the old ways of doing things. There was something unique and new about his ministry that everyone should be alerted to. He was bringing new wine, and it had to be put into new wineskins. It was new cloth, and it couldn't go on old riches. It was a wedding celebration, and so it was a social faux pas to continue to fast. The ministry of Christ was something new and unique and important. Jesus' comparison of the kingdom to the feast is not surprising when you consider that the Old Testament predictions saw it the same way. Go with me to the Old Testament prophet Isaiah and look at chapter 25. And look at verse 6. And in this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of choice pieces, a feast of wines on the lees, of fat things full of marrow, of well-refined wines on the lees. And he will destroy on this mountain the surface of the covering cast over all the people and the veil that is spread over all the nations. He will swallow up death forever, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. The rebuke of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. This is what Isaiah anticipates happening. And Jesus is saying, in no uncertain terms, my coming is the fulfillment of these promises. This is here. It's happening. Rejoice, celebrate, be excited. Once Jesus came, the kingdom burst out of established religious practices, and things would never be the same again. You see, God had worked wonderfully in the past among his people, but now something new, something decisively different, was taking place. It was nothing short of an overthrow of the religious establishment. Look in chapter 11 of Matthew, and verse 11. Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist. John the Baptist was the last of the Old Testament prophets, right? Jesus says, of all people born of women, he's the greatest. Now read on. But he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is to come. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Jesus is overthrowing the religious establishment. He says, look, the Old Testament prophets were great. They were wonderful. They played a critically important role in the redemptive history of God's revelation. John the Baptist was the greatest of them. Of all men born to women, there is none greater than this last of the Old Testament prophets. But understand something. There is something so unique and so new about the coming of Christ and the ushering in of his kingdom that Jesus says, the least in the kingdom, the least in the kingdom is greater than John. That's how refreshing and new and unique is this. From the prophets until now, Jesus says, the kingdom has been suffering violence, and violent people are trying to take it, he says. But understand, they will not triumph. Because my kingdom won't be one of might, it won't be one of power, it won't be one of political force, it won't be one of national greatness. My kingdom will go forth by the power of the Spirit, not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, says the Lord of hosts. And they'll turn the world upside down. That is not to say that Jesus' ministry, however, was so completely new that it had no connection with the past. What does he say in Matthew 5:17? Don't think that I have come to destroy the law and the prophets. I have not come to destroy them, but to what? What's the word? Fulfill. Fulfill. That is, I have continuity and connection with everything that went on before me because they anticipated my coming. They saw it. And what they prophesied about has now come to fruition in me. When John the Baptist says the kingdom of heaven is here, he wasn't kidding. He wasn't wrong. It was here. Jesus is saying, I am the kingdom. I am the one. And I am going to gather to myself people from all nations. And they will belong to me. The disciples of Jesus had a great advantage over Jewish theologians. Their advantage was that they could bring treasures that were new as well as old. Go to Matthew 13. And look at verse 52. Then he said to them, therefore every scribe instructed concerning the kingdom of heaven. And when he means scribe there, he means student, teacher. He means somebody that is a learner. Every scribe instructed concerning the kingdom of heaven, who is like a householder who brings out of his treasure things both new and old. The Old Testament prophets could only bring all of old treasures. They could only see the new treasure in forms and shadows. They could only look at it in the future, and they couldn't see with clarity everything that was going to take place when Jesus came. But now you and I have a great advantage over them. That's why the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than John the Baptist. Not because he's greater morally. Not because he even has a greater impact than John the Baptist. But because he has revelation that John didn't have. He has the ability to bring out of his treasures things that are connected with the old covenant and the revelation of the new. And has the ability to tie those two things together so that he sees both the continuity of the old and the new, but also the discontinuity. He sees how both of them run right through Jesus Christ. The Old Testament prophet didn't have the advantages that you have. You think about that for a moment. You know more about the kingdom of God than Isaiah. Isn't that a remarkable thing? Isaiah, for his time, revealed wondrous and great things about the coming Messiah. But he didn't see with clarity and detail what you see, because you have the benefit of reading Isaiah in the light of the new covenant. Right? John the Baptist was a great man. But there he is languishing in prison, poor guy. Shortly he's going to lose his head. And he sends his disciples to Jesus and says, are you the one? Or should we expect another? And you know what Jesus does? He says, go back and tell John this. And then he recites several things that John, as a scholar of the Old Testament, would have recognized were indications that the Messiah had come. But John didn't see as clearly as you see. That's why Jesus says, John's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Or John's the greatest of men born to women. But the least in the kingdom of heaven, the least in this kingdom that Christ inaugurated when he came, is greater than John. That is, he has greater benefits, greater vision, greater sight than even John because of what he has a chance to see. We must never think of Jesus as some iconoclastic revolutionary who wants to smash everything that has gone on before him. who wants to ignore the law and the prophets, who wants to do away with them. No, 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 no. He was the proper fulfillment of the Old Testament, and his ministry was in complete harmony with the law and the prophets. He says to the Pharisees, "You search the Scriptures because you think in them you have eternal life. But these are they which speak of me. If you believed Moses, you would believe in me because Moses spoke of me." He says, "You think you're children of Abraham. But if you were children of Abraham, you would accept me because Abraham saw my day and he rejoiced." So what Jesus is doing then is taking the Old Testament, the law, the prophets, the writings, and he is now turning the spotlight on them. And guess what they all show? They show him. They display him. And he says, "I now have new wine. I've now brought a kingdom that is to be a celebration. And the old paradigms don't fit. I am the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. And if you're going to understand them, you must understand them through me." Now, I'm going to do something that I'm doing with fear and trepidation, because I'm about to turn a message into a lecture. And I hate to do that. I'm a preacher, not a professor. But it is necessary at this point in our study for me to illustrate in front of you something that is going to now be a stepping stone to how we're going to flesh out some of these thoughts and some of these concepts and see where the rubber meets the road in a lot of areas. Now, if you're taking notes, I want you to draw a horizontal line, okay? Stretching from the right of your paper all the way over to the left. This line is going to be representative of a continuum. And on the left side of the paper, your left, and it'll be my left, on the left side of the paper, I want you to write across the top, put a little bullet point at the end of the line, okay? So it looks kind of like a really, really long barbell. And at the top of this end of the barbell, I want you to put continuity. Then I want you to go all the way out to the other end of the line. I hate you. And I want you to write okay. Now what this line reflects is how Christians today in the church see relationships, and you can put this underneath in the middle of the line, the relationship between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, between the law of Moses and the law of Christ. Continuity between the church and Israel and the relationships of those things. Okay? So you got a line stretching from discontinuity on the right to continuity on the left, and we're going to talk about these things. Over the next few coming weeks, what we're going to do is explore the implications of everything that we have talked about up to this point in this study. So far, I have been laying the foundations. Now we're going to go up. We're going to build on these foundations. We're going to talk about issues that are pertinent to the church and the implications of those issues. Things like this. Is Sunday the Christian Sabbath? The degree to which you see yourself on this continuum will affect how you answer that question. If you are over on this side where you see greater continuity between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, you will view Sunday as the Christian Sabbath. If you are further this direction on the continuum where you see greater discontinuity between the New Covenant and the Old Covenant, you'll see it as the Lord's Day and not the Sabbath. Here's another issue. Who do we baptize? Do we baptize infants and small children or believers? If you are on this side of the continuum line, who are you going to baptize? Little ones. Because they're going to say that circumcision and baptism are equivalents. And in the Old Covenant, we circumcised who? Eight days old. Boys. So in baptism, we should baptize those who are infants. But if we go this direction on the continuum and see greater discontinuity, who are we going to tend to baptize? Only those who can give credible profession of faith in Christ. Here's another issue. What's the relationship of the Christian to the Ten Commandments? To the so-called moral law of God. If you're on this side of the continuum where you see greater continuity between Old Covenant and New Covenant, you're going to say that the Ten Commandments as the eternal moral law of God is binding upon all Christians of all time, just as it was morally binding upon Jews. If you're further in this direction on the continuum so that you see greater continuity, you're going to say the Ten Commandments are only valid for Christians if they are repeated in the New Covenant. Because Christ comes as a new Moses who gives a new law, and you have to take all of Moses or none of him. You see the issues that are raised here? Christians debate and discuss these things all the time. And what I'm trying to do is give you a matrix and a paradigm here for you to wrestle with these things as I flesh them out in coming messages. Here's another question. What's the nature of the kingdom? Is the kingdom present and future, or future only? Where you fall on this continuum will, to a certain extent, help you understand that. Now, let's talk about the two poles, and then we'll talk about the center. Let's start with discontinuity. For the past 160 years, the prevailing hermeneutic, that is the science of interpretation within the church, has stressed discontinuity. If you've got your little bullet point here, you've got discontinuity across the top. Under that, put dispensationalism. Go to the other end of the bar where it says continuity, and what do you put under it? Anybody know? Covenant theology. Okay. Now, what is dispensationalism? In 1830, 1835, an Irish Brethren elder by the name of John Darby began to teach and formulate a system of biblical interpretation that radically emphasized discontinuity. Darby said that not only is there not one single strand of God's dealings with people throughout time, there are in fact seven different epochs of time when God dealt with different peoples based upon different rules. So Darby found the dispensation of innocence and the dispensation of conscience and the dispensation of government and the dispensation of law and grace and finally into the millennial kingdom. In other words, he chopped up God's dealings with people pretty dramatically. Now Darby influenced D.L. Moody and his right-hand man by the name of R.A. Torrey. And they had a young protege just down the road here from Atchison, Kansas, by the name of Cyrus Ingersoll Schofield. And young Mr. Schofield, who was an attorney by trade, learned of this system at the feet of R.A. Torrey, and in 1901 published the best-selling study Bible of all time, the Schofield Reference Bible, in which he codified in the study notes of the Bible the system that Darby had put into place, where he really emphasized discontinuity in God's dealings. Darby emphasized and said strongly that the church is not Israel. In fact, he went a step further, and he said, God has made an eternal, everlasting covenant with Abraham for his physical seed, the nation of Israel. And he has given to that physical seed promises which he will not break. When Christ came into the world, he came to that seed, and Darby said, and a lot of older dispensationalists said it as well, that if the Jews had accepted Christ as Messiah at that moment, they would have set up the millennial kingdom. Which, of course, begs a very important question. On what basis would they have been justified before God? Implicit in Darby's position, in Schofield too, was that the cross was not necessary. It was plan B in God's dealings with the Jews. The Jews rejected Christ. Christ goes to the cross, and he sets up a parenthesis. This is their words, not mine. A parenthesis age. The age of the church. What he called the age of grace. When he dealt with the church, but there would come a time when he would take the church out of the world, and he would begin to deal with Israel again as a national entity. So in the Schofield system, in dispensationalism, there is a wide chasm between Old Covenant and New Covenant, a wide chasm between Israel and the church. That's why we put them on the end here of discontinuity. Now, one other point here, and then we'll move to covenant theology. Dispensationalism is going through radical changes as we speak. Many people in the pews and most preachers may not know it, but this brand of dispensationalism is dead. They haven't had the funeral yet, but it's dead. The leading institution as the promotion of dispensationalism is Dallas Theological Seminary. The founder of Dallas Seminary was a man by the name of Lewis Sperry Chafer, who was a protege of Mr. Schofield. 5-6 years ago, Chuck Swindoll became the new president of Dallas Seminary, and it was asked to him, is Dallas still a dispensational school? And he said, and this is amazing, Chafer must have turned over in his grave, he said, we don't like to use the phrase dispensational. Most modern dispensationalists now agree that all of those nice little neat divisions of all of these seven dispensations, they're not there. And if you didn't have the reference Bible notes to show you where they started and stopped, you wouldn't find them. So dispensationalism, to their credit, are moving along this line of continuum toward greater continuity. Okay? Now let's talk about the other end. Covenant theology is a little older than dispensationalism. Dispensationalism, by the way, has only been around since the 1830s. Nobody in the history of the church for the first 1800 years ever held to those views. On the other end of the spectrum, we have what's called covenant theology. Covenant theology has been around for about 400, 450 years. It's not real, real old either. Covenant theology emphasizes continuity in God's dealings as opposed to discontinuity. And what covenant theology says is this: God makes a covenant of grace with Abraham. And in that covenant of grace, he promises to give him a seed. They rightly understand that seed, according to Galatians, to be spiritual, not physical. That seed will principally be based in the nation of Israel during the Old Covenant era and go to the Gentiles once Christ comes. But it's the same people of God. Whereas dispensationalism say there is at least two different peoples of God, national Israel and the church, covenant theology says there's only one people of God, so that Israel and the church are the same entity. There is differences, of course. One's national, one's spiritual. One is localized in a geographic location. Other is spread out over the globe. There are differences, but in general, the covenant theologians would say there is only one people of God. As a consequence, the old covenant given to Moses at Mount Sinai and the new covenant spoken of by Jeremiah aren't really old and new covenants. According to covenant theologians, the old covenant is an older administrative covenant of the covenant of grace given to Abraham. And the new covenant is really a newer administration of the covenant of grace given to Abraham. So that circumcision isn't a sign of the old covenant, it's a sign of the covenant of grace, administered a certain way until the coming of Christ. Baptism takes its place with the coming of Christ, but it isn't the new covenant sign, it's the sign of the covenant of grace given to Abraham that changes in the new covenant. Now, if you're confused at this point, just get the point. Because circumcision and baptism are seen in this system as the equivalents, they should be given to infants, not to believers. It is my belief, and it's based upon some historical evidence, that covenant theology as a system developed as a defense for paedobaptism, the baptism of infants. Now, I'm going to elaborate on that a lot more when we get to the subject of baptism and why that happened. The Reformed churches that hold the covenant theology, Presbyterian, Christian Reformed, etc., didn't want the baptismal regeneration of both Roman Catholicism and Lutheranism, but they held on to the practice. They had to have a reason why they did that, and I think the system sprung from that. We'll talk about that at length. At this point, all I want you to understand is that on this continuum, dispensationalism on one end, covenant theology on the other end, dispensationalism emphasizes discontinuity, covenant theology emphasizes continuity. Now, in reality, there are many different shades of both of these groups. There's hardly any of either of these groups that are at the very ends of these spectrums. There are some. There are some. For instance, there are Presbyterians who are extremely strict in the observance of Sunday. Extremely strict on what kind of worship goes on in the church and what kind of songs you actually sing in the church. There are dispensationalists who will tell you that really, the Gospels don't even apply to the church. It's not until you get to Acts chapter 2 that things actually really apply to the church. The Gospel is all about the law. It's about Israel. Most people in these two groups aren't on opposite ends. They are in gradations toward the center. Now, if you're sitting here wondering, where's Tony in all of this? I grew up as an ardent dispensationalist. I was weaned on the Scofield reference Bible. There were years when I was so well schooled in Scofield, the Scofield reference Bible, the old Scofield, not the new one, the old Scofield reference Bible, that I wouldn't even know what the verse was, but I would know it was on the right page, just about that far up, and you know I had it underlined and marked, and I could find it. That's how well I knew my Scofield reference Bible. I was raised here, okay? I also am extremely familiar with here, covenant theology. Both groups will tell you, many in both groups will tell you, that they're the only two options out there. Dispensationalists will say you either have to be dispensational or covenant theology. And covenant theologians will say, well, you have to be us or you're a dispensationalist. I don't think that's true. These systems have only been around for 200 to 450 years. Okay? They're not that old. And there is a growing group of scholars that are emphasizing both the continuity between the Old and New Covenants, between Israel and the Church, but not neglecting the discontinuity as well. And in my own theological pilgrimage, I have gone from here to here to about right here. Okay? So that there are things with which I would find myself in agreement with dispensationalists when it talks especially about the relationship of the Church and Israel and about the Old Covenant and New Covenant. Okay? There are also things about covenant theology that I think are right, and which they emphasize that I think are true. And what I am trying to lay out for you in this system is a new paradigm.